tonight on Arena. Dan Hegarty looks forward to a large Irish contingent at this year's Glastonbury, and composer Jennifer Walsh on her new opera, Mars. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Glastonbury 2025 officially getting underway at Worthy Farm in Somerset in England promises 5 days of unforgettable performances and surprise moments. But this year, there's something particularly exciting for Irish music fans. Stellar lineup of homegrown acts take to the festival stages, from breakout stars like CMAT and Sprints, to festival first-timers like Kneecap, to seasoned names like The Script and Snow Patrol, and indeed, I'll come back to that in a second. Irish artists are making a serious impact at Glastonbury this year. The Riptide Movement, that was the name I couldn't think of. They were on with us last night, and they are going to Glastonbury as well.
They sure are.
Suddenly disappeared from my head. Dan Hegarty is with me in studio to talk about it. Really, is it a particularly good year for the Irish, or is this just something that has been happening over the last, I don't know how many years, Dan?
Well, you summed it up there. It's been happening over the past number of years. There's a growing contingent that make it over to Worthy Farm. But yeah, this year does look great. And what I do like about it is there's a kind of a mixture of newer and older bands. You've got bands like the Hot House Flowers, who still play, do great, great shows. If anyone's seen them live in the last number of years, they're playing. And as you mentioned, you've got people like Sprints, who are just an incredible band, and the much talked about Kneecap as well.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to them for sure. What do you think? I know you were saying to me you were there, I think it was 2011, you were there at the festival itself, and you've been watching it and reporting on it for a long time now. What makes Glastonbury, it really does stand out from so many other festivals?
Yeah, some things, the essence of them, you can't quite put into words. And I think Glastonbury is kind of one of those things. It's the history, it's the names that it's brought to play there over the years. Names that you would never expect to see in a festival lineup, like Paul McCartney, like Dolly Parton, like you too. They didn't have to do festivals anymore. They were off doing their own thing for a long, long time. But even the weather, like when it's us sitting there watching on TV and seeing it pouring down and people diving through mud, looks fantastic. That's even become iconic and synonymous with Glastonbury. It's so many things.
Yeah, I think 1997 referred to as Muddy Hell, as far as I know, was pretty much the worst of those years. Although I remember one in more recent times as well.
2011 was pretty wet. I was there. I was feeling pretty smug. I brought some very good rainproofs that obviously weren't quite good enough because I was soaked.
Yeah. And the other, you know, you touch on the history of the festival there. 55 years old this year. 1970 it started in, wasn't it? Yeah. Acts like Mark Bolan, Al Stewart, 1,500 people. I mean, there's probably 1,500 people working at the festival at this stage. But yeah, 1,500 people attended.
Yeah,
but
it's incredible.
And it's something to do with, it was a local farmer who said, I want to have a festival on my farm.
Yeah, and it's grown from there. Like, I was just thinking, what would the chances, the percentages of this surviving and becoming what it is now? Like, 200,000 people going there, and like, you know, I wonder with all the other people involved, you know, peripherally, you're talking close to 250,000. Or at least on their way. So from 1,500 to that amount, it's a quantum leap. And
that's there at it. Not to mention then, I mean, the BBC, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people in BBC land giving out about how much time they'll hand over to Glastonbury. But it takes over the airwaves for this coming weekend. We can get some of it on the terrestrial channels. We can't get the stuff that's on the iPlayer.
There is. I was looking at it and I was saying, oh, we should get into, you know, what you can see. And it just gets so complicated. And so it's so immense that we would only be talking about what you can see this on a particular night. Like, I mean, I made notes. I started on a Friday and then I gave up. I got to later and then even later, and then I went, oh, to hell with it. There's too much going on.
Yeah. Because whatever bit clashes at the festival itself, there are even clashes on the various TV channels. But let us concentrate for a little while on the Irish acts that are going there. I have to say, Is this Seamath's, is it her first appearance? Is this her first appearance or her second appearance at
Well,
at
it's certainly her most high profile.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about that slot, you know.
Where and when is she on?
She's on the Pyramid stage, the main stage on the Friday. And I was looking at some of the people who've played that slot over the years, like Rufus Wainwright played a Friday in 2022 on that slot. Joy Crooks was on the Saturday. Tom O'Dell played that slot on the Sunday in 2019. Blossoms in 2017. Rodrigo y Gabriela in 2014. So that gives you the calibre of the artists that they'll put on at that time.
It's kind of a tea time, mid-afternoon tea time type of...
Yeah, and it means that your songs have broken through to the mainstream, that people know them. And also, not just your songs, your performance. As a performer, you're there. You're not going to go on and look at however many thousand people in front of you and go, oh, I can't do this.
What am I doing here? Yeah, and I think Seamath in particular, I mean, she's had... It's two albums, but it's a meteoric rise, really, hasn't it been?
Just the story of someone who's extremely gifted and very hardworking, has a great manager who works very hard for her too. Mercury Music Prize nominated for Crazy Mad for Me, the current one, and then won the RTÉ Choice Music Prize for the debut. So yeah, it's been an incredible few years for her.
Let's have a listen to her in action. Take a Sexy Picture of Me. Take a Sexy Picture of Me from Seamath, who will be on the Pyramid stage of Glastonbury on Friday afternoon. Dan Haggerty with me in studio this evening, looking in particular at the Irish acts that are taking place. And you were saying as we were listening to that, Dan, how timeless that song is and just the brilliance of so many aspects of it.
Yeah, it's the recording, it's her, it's the songwriting, it's pretty flawless, isn't it?
Yeah, and when people go to see her, they will go to see that performance, they will go to listen to the music. I wonder what kind of attraction there will be to Kneecap, who might be attracting more than those who are interested in their music at the moment.
I mean, is there a more talked about band at the moment?
No.
I don't think so. And I mean, the thing is, like, the people who are outraged by Kneecap, who are there, will probably go and see them because they don't want to miss something spectacular that might happen. The people that are outraged by them, who aren't there, who are watching TV, might just watch it for the very same reason. Performance-wise, I've seen these guys play, and they can really put together a live show. And I think the album that they've released is fantastic too. And everything around that really is open for debate. But really, when it comes to their music, they totally deserve to be there.
But you would guess that things will be pushed to the very edge, without going into any detail, they'll be pushed to the very edge of performance and politics in the one spot for this performance.
That's their thing. It's like comedians. Some comedians really, they sail that close to the edge of the world, you know, and that's what they do.
Yeah, I might come back to a little bit of them later on. Snow Patrol, like Kneecap and Seamath, relatively new in the whole Glastonbury and in the music career. Inhaler, similarly, but a band who have kind of been slowly creeping up on this Glastonbury. I think this is their debut. This will be a big moment for them.
Snow Patrol have played a number of times before.
I was talking about Inhaler there.
Inhaler have just been one of those bands that have been going about their business and doing things, releasing albums, released three albums. The first one was 2021, I think July 2021. Second one was February 2023, and then February 2025. And this is in between touring as well. So they've been really, they don't hang about.
Yeah, and that's how you build an audience, and then you get to these big festivals and you build further. Where are they performing?
In my extensive notes, my printer prints that. You see, there's so much to talk about. I had to print out all my notes. Normally, I would just come in. And you know what? I don't think my printer's printed out that part.
And don't worry, I'm sure we'll get an exact. But they're on over the weekend anyway. And this Glastonbury will be a big launch pad for them. Now, you are going to go into Snow Patrol.
Yeah, Snow Patrol famously had to cancel their 2019 performance because the Johnny from the band got an injury, and But they played back in 2004, and this was the really pivotal part of their career. They'd released that album, Final Straw, produced by Jackknife Lee, which included those big singles like Spitting Game, Chocolate and Run. And 2004 was a big, big performance from them at Glastonbury. And I think them going back with those songs and the songs they've released before and since, it's going to be one of those special Glastonbury moments. If you look at who's played again, similar slots, Avril Lavigne played this slot last year, and she kind of, her career has probably had a similar timeline to theirs.
Yeah, they're on the Sunday evening on the other stage. By the way, Inhaler, it's the other stage as well, but on Friday at 2:15 p.m. That's Friday the 27th. This coming Friday, isn't it? That's all kicking off.
I know.
And I suppose those four that we've spoken about there, CMAT, Kneecap, Inhaler, Snow Patrol, you know, they're the kind of the big headline moments in terms of the Irish contingent there. But there's such a, when I looked through the, even just looking at the billing, there's a huge number of, you know, other very prominent Irish acts who will be part of the whole festival as well.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, Hot House Flowers are playing. Orla Gartland is playing as well, and she recently won the Ivor Novello Award for best song musically and lyrically for her song Mine. That's going to be a special time for her too. Gurriers, another band that are in the sense of touring, they're very Fontaines DC-esque because they never seem to stop. And For Those I Love, who's back, David Balfe, who's back with a new track, he's playing over there as well. So there literally is, when I looked at, oh, which of the Irish artists, how many Irish artists are playing, there's an awful lot more than you would actually think.
Yeah, and even I was looking at somebody like Oisín Leach is in there as well, and you're wondering how that kind of intimacy will work on, I suppose, one of the smaller stages as a different time of the day, when that kind of indie folk type of intimate stuff that you need almost for like a small session in a very small room, it can take, Glastonbury can provide that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the enormity of the site is just something that I couldn't get my head around. You would walk to what you would think would be, oh, there can't be much out here. There'd be another little oasis of stages and all sorts of things going on. I just couldn't get my, you would be 20 minutes getting there too. So it's very hard to put across in words what it is. You really have to go there and kind of immerse yourself in it all.
Let us have a listen. For fear we become too parochial and it's all about the Irish and Glastonbury, there will be people who are not Irish performing there as well. We do have to acknowledge that. Not least of whom will be this gentleman. There he is, Rod Stewart. And there will be those who will be screaming, is he still going to be in Glastonbury? I presume he's been there many's the time before. The legend slot, I believe, on Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening is when Rod Stewart will be making his appearance, Dan Hegarty.
A fitting one, yeah. I mean, he'll go down an absolute storm. I mean, laugh all you will, but he will laugh louder.
Yeah, well, I mean, he sings and writes songs like that, so you can't ignore that. But he is, I suppose, typical of the kind of world class and world beating acts that have performed there over the years. You mentioned some of them earlier on, and how, I still don't quite understand how a festival can attract, you know, the likes of Shirley Bassey, Paul McCartney, as you mentioned earlier on. It seems to be genre defying in terms of who will perform there.
Well, look at it this way: you're an artist. You've been doing, you've done everything. You've won every award. You've played every stadium, every arena. What haven't I done? Yeah. Glastonbury, if it's on that list, you'll go, and the offer comes along, you're more than likely to go, yeah, I'll do that. Like, who would have thought Bruce Springsteen would have played? Who would have thought Neil Young would have played?
I think again this year, Neil Young, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't think I would ever see U2 at a festival. I just didn't think they needed it, and they did a great performance there back in 2011. The list got Guns N' Roses played last year, which
they always have these, you know, and I know this is a typical festival thing, surprise slots, or, you know, to be TBA is what you'll see on the programme. And I wonder to what extent are they going, I hope somebody turns up for that, or do they have kind of people on standby and then they'll be pushing people around the place?
I don't know. Yeah, I do hope, I do hope someone turns up for that. But who knows? Like, I mean, Foo Fighters, was that 2 years ago? Mm. It was 2 years ago. That was fantastic. I can't quite remember who the surprise guest was last year. And I've no idea.
Yeah.
It's someone big, for that matter. It's someone big, someone recognisable. But they keep it so tightly guarded.
Yeah, you just don't know when it will happen. By the way, we were just talking in the production area. We're saying, seemingly, Glastonbury becomes Britain's 11th or 12th biggest city this weekend. I got some really interesting statistics, which I can't confirm, but which I'm prepared to share. The site has more than 3,300 toilets. That's one for every 60 people who attend. Not too much queuing involved there. 700 metres of male urinals. 450 hectares of land is the sprawl. You'd be walking for a long time to walk that land. That's the equivalent of 500 football pitches or 10 Vatican cities. I mean, it is a massive site.
Well, it's a big jump again from what we were talking about earlier on, the first one in 1970, which I read somewhere that each festival goer got free milk from the farm.
It had that was the kind of friendly touch that it started out with. And I think they've tried to maintain that despite the...
You still get free milk?
I don't know if you
get free
milk.
That's a lot of milk.
Would there be a lot of cows milked at the mornings of the various festivals for that to happen? I'm going to go back to Kneecap to finish up with. Are the CMATs, the Kneecaps, the Inhaler, are those the big, and the Snow Patrol, are those the big four for you, really?
Yeah, and I think with acts like that on a festival like Glastonbury, or just internationally, the profile that they have now, much like, artists years ago, maybe in the 80s, like U2 and Sinead O'Connor and others before them, kind of kicked the door open for their generation of artists coming out of Ireland. I think they've done that, them and Fontaines and others have done that for a younger generation of Irish acts as well. And they've put a wedge in it to keep it open. So I think it's it bodes well for music coming from this.
And as obviously you don't have to be travelling there. There is a lot of it on terrestrial television. BBC's 1, 2 and 4, I think, are more or less.
And as you said, I think there is a little bit of an overlap, but they signpost it pretty well. If you want to see whoever it is, hang on, I do have some of it here from the Friday. If you want to see, Alanis Morissette is, I believe, on BBC. Is it BBC 1 or BBC 4? And then there's other stuff going on in BBC Two.
It's wall to wall.
It's complicated.
If you turn on BBC, you'll know what's on when you're watching it, and they'll signpost you to what's on in the other channels. Dan, thanks for coming into us and sharing those thoughts with us. And we'll finish up with a little bit of Kneecap from their slightly more innocent days, if they ever had it, more innocent days. Better Way to Live, featuring Graham Chatton, of course. Got a little peak one day, made me feel a go of 7. I know it exists, but I can't stop getting pissed. One more thing, I'll be added to the list. Kneecap with Graham Chatton there, and Better Way to Live, and that all by way of letting you know that Kneecap will be part, like so many others, it's other Irish music acts, of this year's Glastonbury Festival. In fact, Kneecap will be on the West Holts stage on Saturday afternoon at 4 p.m. and the BBC, we shouldn't be advertising other stations, but nevertheless, if you want to catch up on Glastonbury, that's where you can do it over the weekend. Would you like to take a trip to Mars? Well, if you're not a billionaire like Jeff Bezos, currently busy preparing for his wedding in Venice, then why not take a trip to Mars through the power of your imagination, or perhaps through the imagination of Jennifer Walsh, who has been called one of the world's most exciting contemporary classical composers. Her new opera is called Mars. She is with me in studio this evening to tell me more about this opera, commissioned by Irish National Opera, premiere at the Galway International Arts Festival next month, and then a run at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin afterwards. Jennifer, delighted that you're actually across the table from me. I think you've been thinking about Mars for a very long time. In fact, it goes back. Did the obsession start as a child?
The obsession did start as a child. My father had a copy of Cosmos by Carl Sagan, an illustrated copy, and I was very interested in that and interested in the planet Mars. But I suppose I've been thinking about it in very acute detail for about the past, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. I, as a composer and as any visual artist or writer or filmmaker I know now, there's this huge pressure to be producing big projects one after the other at great speed. And a few years back, I thought I'd like to pick one sort of territory and stick with that for a while and just come at it from different angles. And I knew I wanted it to be Mars, because if you start talking about Mars, you get to talk about basically everything about our life.
Yeah, today. I was going to ask you about that. Is it somehow, does Mars and the mythology around Mars, the reality, the scientific knowledge around Mars, how does that feed into a huge number, I think, of contemporary issues?
Well, I mean, to begin with, when you talk about Mars, you're talking about something that's amazing and wonderful, which is a planet that we've never been to, that we're all obsessed with and that we have ideas about.
The one that's nearest to us, isn't
the
it?
One that, yeah. It's the one that's, you know,
or
that we think,
no, it's not nearest.
We think that this is the only viable one that we can get to because Venus is covered in, you know, clouds of toxic fumes, whereas Mars is merely unbreathable and freezing cold. But what's interesting to me is, like, if you think of the 20th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, they thought that it was possible that there was foliage on Mars, that there were plants. And it was only when there was the first flybys that they realized, no, it's bleak. It's a bleak desolation, like the moon, just a different type of desolation. So we think about that planet a lot. A lot of the space billionaires and the tech oligarchy would have us think that that's our plan B, that, you know, somehow, despite the fact that we haven't managed to solve the climate emergency on Earth, we can miraculously terraform a planet that's 140 million miles away with no oxygen, and sort of build ourselves a new place to live. So instantly, if you're talking about the climate emergency, if you're talking about tech billionaires and space billionaires, you're talking about some of the most pressing issues of our time.
Yeah. And in fact, what the story that you tell in the opera, it starts out with that, what is a group of women, a group of, they're traveling to Mars.
Yep.
So it's quite exciting in terms of that scientific exploration. And it's always struck me that, I think it's there across lots of your work, this mixture or this meeting of science and art, which I'm guessing in your mind are not two separate things at all.
Well, I'm a huge sci-fi nerd. So I think that when I come to working on art, I'm coming at it through the lens of the sci-fi nerd, I suppose, rather than the lens of the scientist. But as a sci-fi person, I'm interested in what we might call hard sci-fi, which means science fiction that's really tries to be as scientifically informed as possible. And so uses that as like great raw material and inspiration, useful constraints to make imaginative fantasies happen. So certainly with the opera, I was very interested early on in everything from what is the music that the astronauts on the ISS listen to? What is the ambient sound environment like on the ISS?
At the International Space Station.
Yeah. In exactly. Through to historical ideas of how you represent the cosmic or the planetary in music, and right through to NASA's wonderful selection of recordings that were made by the microphone on the Perseverance rover up on Mars. So all of that, you know, sort of putting that in the pot together.
Yeah, because I was kind of amazed, you know, when I think of space, I think when a lot of people think of space and you see a spaceship going through space, it's this silent piece of machinery floating through darkness, and the light is catching it because it's in the midst of all the darkness. They are incredibly noisy places.
They're unbelievably noisy. And all of the recordings I could gather of the ISS, of different modules of the ISS, they're all unbelievably loud. And you realize, you know, when you see Chris Hadfield or somebody like that up there doing a broadcast, they're doing it over a microphone that has an incredibly heavy EQ applied to it so that it's just taking their voice and not the of all the machines keeping them alive. So I took great pleasure in taking some of those recordings and then transcribing them into these strange microtonal textures for instruments to play, so that the, you know, the singers know they're playing with like they're singing against a weird version of the ISS modules.
Yeah, and Mark O'Connell, isn't it, who is involved as the librettist here, and again, his book, I suppose, To Be a Machine, the one that many will know from recent years, is would you refer to that as hard sci-fi, or would you describe Mark? He's not science fiction really, is he?
I mean, because Mark, one of the things I really love about Mark's writing is you know, it's very personal. It's sort of like To Be a Machine is really about him trying to think through all these issues of transhumanism and what it means for a body to have a technology applied to it and maybe live beyond the bounds of our lives that we might think we're doomed to. But when it came to working on the opera, I was really convinced that it had to be somebody like Mark, who's been thinking through these scientific issues and particularly issues around tech and about Silicon Valley and about how tech is changing our lives, because those are really important themes, you know, whenever we start talking about Mars.
So give us a sense of the story of the opera, because there is a quite definite two-act structure this, and a big event happens towards the end of the first
happens.
Act.
So we start off with our four female astronauts on the Buckminster. That's the name of their spaceship, named after, of course, Buckminster Fuller.
And they're the big Buckminster Fuller being
the amazing sort of, I suppose you would call him a polymath. You know, he invented the geodesic dome, so he's known for those. There's a you know, really sort of interesting American science thinker, very utopic. And so the astronauts are off to Mars. It's a sort of a, you know, a intra-governmental NGO, you know, multiple agencies working together in the interests of science.
Across all nationalities.
Across all nationalities. There is no commerce involved. Mars has already, people have already been to Mars, so they're not going to be the first people on Mars. And they travel to Mars. And one of the things I think is really important about space travel is lots of it is really, really boring and really, really long. So today or yesterday we were working on a scene and I was saying to my astronauts, you know, or I should say our astronauts, because there's a huge crew of us working with them, you know, if you're exiting the spaceship, you would have been in an airlock for a very, very long time. You know, it would have taken, it's not just like in a movie where they go, you know, airlock decompressed, you know, depressurized, prepare to leave.
What time would you be, could you be in it? Like, are we talking hours?
I've seen like on when they're, you know, they send capsules up to the ISS or they're going from the ISS out for spacewalk, they have to go through all these breathing protocols where they're trying to remove certain chemicals from their blood, or and then they're often waiting there for 45 minutes or something like that as things are depressurizing. So I was sort of saying to, you know, the performers, like, you know, in reality you'd be waiting here for like a third of the length of the opera, but we've got to speed that up.
Yeah, you can't really do that. There's not a lot of drama in hanging about for 45 minutes.
So our astronauts go off to Mars and we have to compress what it would normally be about 9 months into less than an hour. And, you know, things go wrong. Their USB of the Criterion collection, they discover they left it on Earth.
This is the movies that they wanted to bring
exactly,
with them.
Exactly. And they were going to watch, you know, Agnes Varda and loads of really amazing world cinema. And instead, they only have Real Housewives and Shrek the Third. And so there's sort of tensions develop. So, you know, this sort of things that you would imagine would happen on a very long journey.
Yeah. So, which gets across, of course, there's heavy and high science involved in the concepts of what you're talking about here, but there's also very human comedy.
It's very, very, you know, black gallows humor throughout the whole thing, you know, which I think is very much Mark O'Connell and I. It's our common way of approaching the world.
And then when we think all of these NGOs and these wonderful research people who are almost doing it, not quite pro bono, but certainly for the love of the knowledge and for the love of what they may or may not discover, who takes over?
A Silicon Valley billionaire called Axel Parchment and his company Shadowfax Ventures buy out the mission. So the mission is bought and it's now become a commercial enterprise. So this is sort of, that's our, I don't want to say any more because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who might come, but like that's the essential problem that occurs, the crisis in the plot.
Which suggests to me though that you potentially, am I right in thinking, see that as a problem? I mean, if we think to the great explorers, if we go back to exploring this globe, never mind space and outer space, and initially that started as, well, it sounds like a great quest for knowledge to find other peoples, to find other lands. Very quickly it became colonization and what's in it for me? What money can I make out of this?
Exactly. And I think you know, there's a fantastic book that I read working on the opera called A City on Mars by Zach and Kayleigh Wienersmith. And in that, they sort of really try in really maniacal detail to go into what would happen if people landed on Mars. How would they try to claim different parts of it or claim the minerals underneath the surface? There is an outer space treaty, you know, which you know, we haven't tested so far, but, you know, space is supposed to be a commons. It's not supposed to be the property of any one country. Yeah. But we can see there's already a great deal of interest in mining, in drilling, in moving heavy industry into you know, low Earth orbit off Earth. So somehow...
Not satisfied with exploiting all of the resources of this planet. We want other planets as well.
Exactly. So I think The first space race, it's deeply inspiring, awe-inspiring to see people working together to put somebody on the moon, you know, and to retrieve them and bring them back to Earth safely. You can't not be awed and touched by that. But it's also a commercial enterprise and a political enterprise. You know, it's a country battling it out against another country to show that they're on top. And the space race was something that was sold commercially to the American public as a desperate need. So I think we see commerce come in more and more now. The dream is still there and the awe will still be there. And even if, you know, it's a commercial company that put somebody on Mars before, you know, a government or a country, I'll still cry my eyes out, you know, and be awe-inspired watching that. Yeah. You know, that doesn't take away from it. And I suppose that's the weird cognitive dissonance we all have to hold when we start thinking about space travel now.
You have worked towards this in an opera. It's an hour long. Is that what you said?
It's 2 hours.
Two hours long. Yeah. 2 hours long. So, an hour.
There's a break.
For the first time.
You can go for a drink.
Yeah, there is an interval. Yep. When the big event happens, yep, as it were. It was Libris Solar. One of the steps towards realizing this, or was that a totally separate work?
That was a separate work, but I would say it's a really important work because Tom Creed, the fantastic director, he directed the film version of Libris Solar. And then I was delighted that Tom agreed that we could co-direct Mars together. So he's fantastic and I'm learning a huge amount from him.
Because I have a little section from Libris Solar here, some of the music. Is it emblematic of the style of what you're going to give us in Mars, or is that too simplistic to say it's like this?
I don't know. It's difficult to say anything's like anything else. It has singing and instruments in it, but also we've got electronics in Mars and things like that. You know, we've got more. Having like dug through so many different electronic sound files, everything from, you know, the sound files that NASA would put up saying, here's a recording of what sound is like on Mars, through to random B-roll I found in the NASA archives online of...
All of it makes its way in there.
All this sort of different sort of like plasma waves breaking over, you know, the Orion capsule when they tested on re-entry. All these different things are in there too.
Well, give me a sense of, because we hear lovely melodic singing at the at the front end of this piece of Libris Solar, but underneath it then there's a lot of... talking going on. Where does that come from, or what is that?
That's actually from it's text taken from the philosopher Alfonso Lingis, who unfortunately passed away recently, and he was this wonderful philosopher, and it's him talking about what you find at the bottom of the sea. And I suppose it makes sense in that you descend to the bottom of the ocean, it's just as dangerous as ascending up into the stars.
Into the outer space. Let's listen to a little bit of this section of Libris Solar. Little section there from Libris Solar, the music of Jennifer Walsh, who's with me in studio this evening, speaking about her upcoming opera Mars, which will be at Leisureland in Galway.
Yes.
And I think you're quite excited about that particular venue for reasons that link into space exploration and how astronauts must train to go to space.
Well, when astronauts are training at NASA, and I say all this, I've never been to NASA, like, call me, I'll come, I'll get on the plane tomorrow. No, but, you know, I've read a lot about these neutral buoyancy pools that they train in, and they have divers assisting them all the time because they're in their EVA suits, like submerged in water. And so when we first went to visit Leisureland, you know, there was a very strong smell of chlorine as I entered it, and there was a pool, and I thought, oh my God, we could write this first section where they're training in the pool. But there is something quite magical about Leisureland because it's huge. The space is huge and it's a very deep purple. So as Aidan Cosgrove, who's designing the stage and lighting, said, we can make things disappear. We can make things feel like they're floating in space. So it's quite fantastic. Galway International Arts Festival are really masters at building venues inside things that are not normally
theatre venues. One final question. It's not that you have used actual dust from Mars, but you've used kind of what NASA had, the replica dust from Mars. Is that a way of putting it?
There's a company that developed what they call Martian Mohave Simulant, MMS, which is this dust that's supposed to be chemically as similar as possible to the dust that you'd get on Mars, so that when you're testing the rovers, you can test it in similar conditions and see if the dust gets stuck or if it corrodes the metals. So it was a very difficult process to get some of it out of America into
legally and with permission
and stuff, because FedEx were very confused over what they were shipping. But we have some of that. It has huge, big, toxic chemical symbols on it, so I don't feel comfortable asking any of the percussionists to use it. But I did use it. I was commissioned to make a podcast, an ASMR style podcast for the European Broadcast Union, and I myself handled the MMS.
You played the Martian dust percussion instrument.
Yeah, but we've all sorts of other stuff. We've got, you know, astronaut food. We've got anything we could get which we felt was similar. I tried to approximate what is 38% gravity, because the gravity on Mars is 38%. So at one point, the double bassist plays with balloons attached to their bow to try to simulate, you know, so how their bow would feel.
The bow is lighter then. It's kind of floating up into the air. And
exactly.
The double bassist has to pull it down.
And they have to pull it down. So there are, our performers are working a lot to try to simulate zero gravity, 38% gravity, all these different types of gravity in the rehearsal room.
Well, I must say, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It's brilliant crack.
Getting
I can't
to play
lie.
Around. Yeah. Jennifer Walsh talking to us there, composer and performer. Great to have you with us in studio this evening, Jennifer. Mars, the opera, premieres at Leisureland in Galway, 25th, 6th, 7th of July, before moving to the Abbey Theatre for performances on the 7th, 8th, 9th of August. Libretto is by Mark O'Connell, as we said. Jennifer Walsh co-directs with Tom Creed and Aidan Cosgrave on lighting and design. Now, if you're lucky enough to be walking along the Prom in Salt Hill listening to us right now, well, you may be inspired by the landscape, as was my guest right now, jazz singer Emily Jane Cook. She's sitting across from me in studio, ready to perform. And this is from, when we get there, will be from your new EP, Emily Jane, which is called To Promenade. So Salt Hill and Galway and the Galway Promenade are very much at the heart of this piece of music.
Yes, definitely. Big fan and really, like, just love the landscape of Galway, and has really shaped all of my music so far. To Promenade is a 5-track EP that's going to be released on Friday, and it's kind of like a love letter to Galway in a way. It does explore other themes of transformation and growth, and that's all quite introspective, but using the landscape of Salt Hill.
And I would presume, in my cliched way, that if you said, oh, well, I was inspired by the landscape of Salt Hill and Galway, oh, this is going to have a traditional Irish feel to it, but this is quite definitely jazz. Where did that aspect of music come into your life?
Yes, so I actually had an uncle who studied jazz as I was growing up, and then I went on to do a course in jazz myself and found that I just got a real love for contemporary jazz, especially in my later years of studying. And I just liked to create a mix of sound, and everything I do is quite atmospheric. So I use contemporary jazz and free jazz, but there's a bit of folk as well. Mm. And there's also musical theatre, because I like musical theatre, and groove and funk, everything.
And am I going to hear all of that in the song of your own that you're going to perform for us?
Not all of it, but you'll definitely hear more contemporary kind of music.
A contemporary feel to it. In Run For Me, do you improvise within this, or is it pretty much set as a composition and you give it as I'm about to hear it?
There is some improvisation. So improvisation comes from piano. I have my lovely friend Kaelin Zippeli here playing piano, and he's also the piano player on the track itself. Mm. And so there is definitely improvisation there, but in terms of lyrically, it's all set.
And the Galway landscape is quite definitely the inspiration here.
Yes, definitely.
Let's hear Run For Me, Emily Jane. Definitely. Thanks.
Thank you.
Absolutely beautiful. Run For Me there from Emily Jane Cook. And I love that little section at the end when Keelan drops out. I should say that it was Keelan Zippoli who was accompanying there on piano. When he drops out, how exposing is that for you as a jazz singer to just be left there, you, your voice, nothing else?
I love it. It's really nice to have that kind of space. And this is a very emotional song for me. And so to have that change of I'll Run For Me, it feels really lovely. It's my favourite part of the song.
Yeah, it really does stand out. And it exposes the beauty of your voice as well as everything else. How strong is the jazz scene then in Galway?
In Galway, it's definitely getting stronger. I would be based more in Dublin, but there's definitely a thriving scene down there. Lots of amazing musicians from there, especially Roisin Moulier. She's a singer that I work with. And then in Dublin, there's so many different series run. There's the Kind of New series, the Dublin Jazz Co-op, Home Cooking as well is really good. And there's also Irish Women in Jazz, which would be one of my favourite series to be a part of.
Is it launch in Dublin then this coming?
Yes. So it'll be in Hen's Teeth and doors will be open at 12:30. So it's a daytime gig, family friendly, accessible, and it's going to be really, really nice.
That's Emily Jane talking about her debut to prominent. What's happening on Sunday?
So that's the launch itself. And then the EP will be released on Friday. Yeah. Yes.
So the launch is the EP released on Friday and the launch will be on Sunday at Hen's Teeth, 12:30 p.m. Sunday lunchtime jazz show. What better can you get? Emily Jane and Keelan, thanks for coming in to us this evening. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Sheedy's research. John Byrne was the broadcast coordinator. Paul Murnock was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.